So good evening. We're starting a little early today. Welcome to episode 32 of the Political Might podcast. I have with me a very special guest, Mr. Tim Alston, the author of the U.S. and the Coronavirus, The Rise of Silver Medalist Leaders. A very interesting book, and we're going to dive into it momentarily. But right after, we're going to have another dynamic panel discussion. So right now, I want to introduce my very distinguished and accomplished guest, Mr. Tim Alston. For 44 years, Tim Alston received industry awards for marketing and public relations, higher education administration, and customer service retention expertise with private universities, multinational public relations agencies, and a broadcast satellite service company. Then, more importantly, God revealed to him his special calling / ministry for servant leadership, recovering from his own addiction to self-egoholism, as well as embracing his lifelong personal and professional leadership from the middle. Now, most importantly, Mr. Alston has dedicated his life to creating services and products, addressing both egoholism, recovering, and silver medal leadership, achieving your number oneness by embracing your number two-ness. As a result, he has written and published in 2017, Seven Steps to Manage Ego Problems, the How-To Guide for Somebody Else, a free downloadable ebook on his website, www.timalston.com. In 2020, just last year, he published The U.S. Coronavirus Crisis and the Rise of Silver Medal Leaders. And this upcoming March of 2021, Tim Alston will be publishing his third book, U.S. Politics, The Rise of Silver Medal Leaders, which recaps the 2020 presidential election in light of Bible best practices and the servant leadership style of Jesus Christ. Mr. Tim Alston, it's such a privilege and honor to have you join me on the Political Mic this afternoon.
Mike, I'm honored to be here. I bring you greetings from your alma mater and from the people that helped to shape you, particularly Preston Foster.
Thank you. And I want to start off the conversation because you discuss in your book, you know, the spiritual significance of the number 40, for example. You point to specific examples, Noah and the Great Flood, Moses and Mount Sinai. You point to Jonah's mandate for the city of Nineveh to fast and pray for 40 days for forgiveness. But you also make the connotation to the 40-day significance in terms of the coronavirus crisis. You say that similarly during a 40-day window in 2020, we witnessed a crisis preparation which resulted in a change de facto of national leadership. Could you elaborate on that, sir?
Certainly. As I said, and as you said very, very well, those of us who are students of the Bibles and followers of Jesus Christ know that the number 40 is extremely significant in terms that it marks preparation. And in the United States, as you just mentioned, there was a 40-day period that went from the first indication to the president, President Trump at the time, former President Trump, that there was a problem that was brewing in this country. He was at a conference in Davos, Switzerland, and he blew it off and said, no, it's not a problem at all. He says, we've got it totally under control. And in the introduction in the book, I take the time to walk through those first 40 days that should have prepared the United States, that should have prepared the federal government and top leadership for this deadly coronavirus crisis, which we are unfortunately commemorating as a one-year anniversary this week. And what happened, unfortunately, is they did not prepare. Their responses were slow, low, and no. And the book is about those five governors who stepped up and stepped in and began to save many, many lives. And they began that process within that 40-day preparation period.
So if you could elaborate on which governors to you stood out in this moment of crisis, and also how did these state governors exhibit the servant leadership style that you talk about that's similar to that of Jesus Christ in your book?
Well, thank you. The five governors that I point to in the book, I point to the five governors who really stepped up. Number one, there was Gavin Newsom, and Gavin Newsom was in the governor of the state of California. He issued the first nationwide stay-at-home order on March 19th. And then 4 days later, the governor of the state of Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, then issued a stay-at-home order. In February, even before that, the first coronavirus death happened in the state of Washington, and its governor, Jay Inslee, issued an emergency state, a state of emergency in that state. And then Governor Larry Hogan, the only Republican in that group. And from his position as the chair of the National Governors Association, he began to push the governors to begin to take this event seriously. But the main governor that I focus on in the book is the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, because his daily morning press briefings became, as you can remember well, Michael, they became the must-see TV for the entire nation, including those who were officials in the Trump administration. So those governors, and then you can add to that governor of the state of Oregon, Kate Brown, and also Jay Pritzker from Illinois. And these governors, all these governors that I mentioned, got ridiculed and derided by the president, who was not doing his job. And the point that I make in the book is that the coronavirus crisis is just the backdrop. The real issue was that of people typically in number two positions are constantly being devalued.
And so, you know, just to elaborate a little bit more on Governor Cuomo's role in this, because in recent weeks, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice has engaged in a criminal probe into nursing home deaths in New York related to the coronavirus pandemic. And it was revealed that disclosure of that probe, in the disclosure of that probe, that the New York's Attorney General, Letitia James, said that deaths related to those settings were being underreported by the Cuomo administration by as much as 50%. Being that you're going to be publishing a new book in spring, is anything going to change in terms of how Governor Cuomo handled this pandemic? I've had guests on both sides of the aisle just recently, last week, criticize Governor Cuomo for what seems to be this grave mistake. In your view, does that do anything to tarnish his servant leadership, in your view?
No, it really doesn't, because what my book does, Michael, it focuses on those first 3 months of the coronavirus crisis and the lack of proper handling by the federal government and the tremendous crisis management on the part of those five governors. When I would watch, for example, Governor Andrew Cuomo in his press briefings, what gave me encouragement is watching some of the initiatives that were happening. Number one, because they became the epicenter of the nation, arguably the world, because of the coronavirus crisis. What he helped to bring to light, number one, was, well, at least to talk about, was the White House was talking about this disease came from China and came across the country. What the Cuomo administration showed, the fact that it really came to the U.S. primarily out of Europe, that it may have started in China, but it came from Europe. The other thing that he did, which I found very interesting, was because of the crisis and stepping up into the crisis, what he would do for the first time, hospitals in the state of New York had never ever come together in a singular organization and a singular initiative. And the Cuomo administration was able to organize them. The other thing that I noticed from watching the press briefings was that because we went into a stay-at-home order across the country, and as a result, colleges and universities were emptied out. Therefore, he also made the provision for those empty dormitories, those residence halls, to be made available should they have an overflow in the hospitals. And I also began to notice, and this was, I really take great pride in this in the book, was the fact that he then not only handled New York, but brought together the governors of Massachusetts, the governor of New Jersey, the governor of Connecticut, even the governor of Delaware, and they formed a regional alliance to address this problem. Because as he said, and so many have said, the coronavirus crisis knows no boundaries, no geographical boundaries. It knows no ethnicity. And so they began to come together and began to resolve the problems. And I contend that they helped to save many, many American lives. And also in the book, what I do, interestingly enough, since you mentioned Cuomo, because of what he did in those first couple of months, there was a strong, strong parallel to me between the servant leadership style of Andrew Cuomo and the servant leadership style of Jesus Christ. And I address that in chapter four when I say, ask the question, who is the real King of Queens?
So if you can, could you elaborate for the audience what a silver medalist leader is? And also, you know, in your view, how do the state governors who stepped up to the plate during this pandemic fit that role, being that they're the chief executive of their state?
Okay. What I talk about is the national problem of the coronavirus crisis, and the national top leadership failed. And so therefore, when the top leadership failed, then the national number two leaders, hierarchically, those leaders would become the governors of the states. So they became what I call the silver medalist. Now, a silver medalist, and that is the part of the title of my book and the title of the book series, a silver medalist possess three characteristics. Number one, a silver medalist, just like you, Michael, when you worked up on the Hill, just like when you worked for Attorney John David, a silver medalist is a person, A, who reports to someone in their organization. That organization could be the family. That organization could be their social group. That organization could be their workplace or their worship place. So because they report to someone, they are silver. And then they are metal because in their task and their assignments, they carry out their task and assignments with character, with fortitude, and with courage. So therefore, they have metal, M-E-T-T-L-E. And then they are able to be victorious and fruitful because, not because of their title or not because of their top position, they become fruitful and successful because of their influence and their relationships, which is the definition of a leader. So therefore, that makes them silver medal leaders. Initially, I began to believe that silver medal, M-E-D-A-L, medal leaders, were those people who were perceived to be in number two positions in their organization. And those would be, on first blush, on a professional level, persons who had as the first word in their job title, either the word assistant, or the word deputy, or the word vice, or the word second. On a personal level, I contend that those who are the silver medal leaders are those people who report to someone in their organizations at home. And the home, in the traditional home, that would typically be the wife or that second child. In a single parent household, that would be either the eldest or the elder child. And typically that number two person, that silver medal person, is the one who is the traffic cop. They are the courier. They're the ones who are, as I say, they are bilingual. They carry messages from the top to the bottom because they understand the language of both the top and the bottom. And they're also the ones who are the least regarded in their organizations. And I make the point in the book, Michael, that an organization can make it for a short period of time without a top leader, but an organization cannot thrive or even survive without those leaders from the middle, those silver medal leaders. We make up 90% of the organizations.
So in explaining the challenges of being a leader from the middle, Mr. Alston, you compare that to the sinking of the Titanic ocean liner that took place in 1912, over 100 years ago. Could you explain?
Surely. The Titanic was supposed to be the unsinkable ship. The captain was Edward John Smith. He was a British Navy officer at one time, and he was supposed to be the best at the best. When they began to navigate from England over to the United States, he saw an iceberg, and he really only paid attention to the iceberg, which was the top of the iceberg, that top 10%. What he did not calculate, and what to his loss and the loss of the 1,496 people on board, was the majority of the iceberg, that 90%, was below the surface. And many times in our organizations, we fail to recognize and to understand and to give respect and affirmation to those who are that 90%, those who are the people who are below the surface. And so when we only focus on the top, we're only getting 10% of the organization. But the Titanic should have shown us, the sinking of the Titanic, that the strength and the power of the organization is 90%, or that which is below the radar, below the surface.
So you've stated that former President Donald Trump's failure being that he was the president, he was a number one leader, and that he'd never been a number two person. Could you elaborate about the audience? Yeah,
sure. In all of my research, on Donald Trump, and I make the case that Donald Trump, in this last decade, the decade of the 2010 to 2020, I contend that Donald Trump was the most influential person in the United States, the most influential. And when I look at how he did not succeed against all of the things, the number one thing that I noticed as respect to my book and dealing with this issue is that no time in his life did he ever report to anybody, which is the first criteria for being a silver medal elitist. Silver, you report to someone. When his father sought to teach him, for example, the business of real estate, when his father was a kingpin of real estate in Brooklyn and Queens, Donald Trump ran over to Manhattan, didn't want to be there in Brooklyn and Queens. You know, as you know, as a student, and as you know, as an aspiring attorney and an aspiring politician, what gives you your props are the fact that you've come up through the ranks, that you've been vetted all along, first maybe being an appointed person at an office, and then you get elected. And each rung you, Donald Trump came in as a celebrity. He had never had to report to anyone. He never had a board of directors. He never had a board of advisors. As we heard him in his acceptance speech at the 2016 election, Democratic National Convention, he said, "I alone can fix the problem." Well, if you have had any experience being a number two person coming up through the ranks, paying dues, you recognize the fact that that's just not true and that it requires patience. I talk about the path, patience, proper attitude, T, teachable spirit, H, humility. Mr. Trump had none of those things. And it became a clear example of, as you will learn as you get involved in your legal practice, Michael, leadership magnifies defects.
So, Mr. Elston, what triggered your interest in leaders from the middle, specifically number two people?
Well, I began to face the reality. I've been, to be real honest with you, Michael, I've been running from God for most of my life. And finally, I just kept praying and praying, "Lord, what is your will?" And he showed me basically the story of Moses and said, "What is that in thine hand?" Exodus 4:2. What was in my hand was the fact that I had been a number two person all of my life, whether I liked it or not. My parents had four children. I was child number two. You know, I grew up in the second largest city in the Northeastern United States, in the greater Boston, Massachusetts area. And I was educated for lower middle and high school in the world's second largest private school system, which was the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Professionally, when I graduated from college from Hampton Institute at the time, now Hampton University, I took a job as an assistant account executive. Then I later went back to Hampton as the assistant director of public relations. And then I went to a PR firm in Chicago as the account executive. And then I went to another small PR firm as a vice president. Then back to Hampton. I went back to Hampton as assistant director of freshman study. So I've been in a number two position all my life. As a matter of fact, Michael, I really thought that I was about to turn the corner and get out of my number two-ness. It was 1994. I had just gotten my MBA in business management. But more importantly, I was about to marry my wife, Elaine Hamilton. And I was bragging to one of my friends, one of my future groomsmen. I said, hey, Daryl Dixon, at the end of this year, end of 1994, I'll have both my master's and my missus. And he looked at me, he was a married man, he looked at me and says, "No, Tim, trust me. At the end of 1994, you will have two masters." And now I understand that intimately. So as I began to look at what God had just laid in my lap, that of number two-ness, I then began to study it and pray about it. And I began to realize the fact that there are more of us who are number two than number one. Organizations can't make it without number two people. And I recognize the fact that the number two-ness, the issue of number two-ness, really biblically boils down to what we call the great controversy.
So in you know, looking at the comparison between a number one leader and number two leader, specifically as it relates to now that we're in a new administration, we have a changing of the guard. We have, for instance, appointees, presidential appointees who have been confirmed this week. What is more difficult, being a number two leader or, in your view, or a number one leader? And if you can plug in, you know, specific examples of who would fit each criteria.
That's an excellent question. Being a top leader, Michael, is tough. It's very, very tough. You have a lot of spotlight, a lot of limelight on you. And Rick Warren says in his book, Purpose-Driven Life, You have to be careful of the limelight and spotlight because it will blind you. But I contend, and I contend in my book, it is even tougher, much tougher, being a number two person. And the reason I say being a number two leader is tougher is because you have the experience, you have the ability and the experience of communicating from the bottom and communicating with the top. You know how to speak the language of both. You are typically the courier or the traffic cop. The one thing that you lack many times is just the exposure of being at the top. The other thing that happens is every now and then when top leadership is not there, you become that top leader, but for a short period of time. And some of us don't know how to handle not being the top person. It is easy, it is tougher to be that number two person because you are primed, ready, experienced, exposed, but many times you have to wait around for that opportunity. This new administration, as you talk about, Michael, is a prime example of that. We have in the White House now two people who are case studies of being silver medalists. Number one, both of them were in number two positions nationally. They were senators. Both of them had failed in their efforts to move up higher in the hierarchy in terms of the primaries. But yet they were elected because people, the American people, felt that they felt what they felt. And more specifically, the fact that they have tried to get promoted and did not. American people know how to feel that. The fact that Joe Biden has experienced the pain of death, have lost his first wife, his first daughter, his first son. People can relate to that. The fact that Kamala Harris at 7 years old lost her parents in divorce. The fact that Joe Biden stutters like 1% of the American population. The fact that, Kamala Harris has been through gender and racial discrimination. People understand that because that's where they are. But now to the point that you make, if you look at the appointees of the Biden administration, the majority of them are coming out of number two positions and have been elevated by time and circumstances into number one slots.
And so, you know, in your book, you do make a lot of spiritual, biblical parallels to, you know, what's playing out right now in terms of this changing of leadership, addressing the national crisis, and not just the coronavirus, but, you know, it's racial injustice, racial unrest. You know, there's so much to unpack with this book. But if you could share just briefly with the time remaining, could you elaborate on a little bit of, you know, more on some of the parallels you make in your book to similarities between what takes place in the Bible and how they have connotations for today?
Okay. One of the parallels that I make in the book is I compare, Governor Andrew Cuomo with that of Jesus Christ. Particularly as I looked at Andrew Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, in those first 2 months, March and April. And I make the point in chapter four, it's a chapter entitled, Who is the Real King of Queens? Since he and Trump are both from Queens, I make the parallel between JC, Jesus Christ, and AC, Andrew Cuomo. First of all, both of them were mentored by their fathers. Andrew Cuomo by Mario Cuomo and Jesus by both his heavenly father and earthly father. And then both of them also showed public empathy for their mothers. At the height of the coronavirus crisis, Governor Cuomo named the bill to help people out, the Matilda bill, after his mother, Matilda Cuomo. And when Jesus was at his highest point of agony on the cross, he turned to John and said, John, my mother, she's now your mother, take care of her. The other thing I liked about it is that, believe it or not, you know, neither Jesus nor Andrew Cuomo were really gunning for the spotlight, the top spot. You know, when his brother Chris Cuomo at CNN would ask him, are you running for president? He said, no. He said, I've already been to Washington. I don't need that. Jesus kept saying, I'm not trying to set up an earthly kingdom. The other thing was the fact that each of them knew how to step into a crisis situation, and both of them knew how to use the power of storytelling. What got Cuomo his big props were his PowerPoint presentations. And what got Jesus his big points was his ability to tell stories very effectively. Every situation that Jesus ran into, he said, let me tell you a story. And that because people love stories. And so in that respect, they paralleled each other. And what I love to talk about is when a person goes through the Bible, they will begin to see parallels to what is happening in our current society. And that's what my next book is about, in terms of paralleling the 2020 presidential election with stories in the Bible.
And so if you could just, you know, get us a little excited for that next upcoming work. You know, that upcoming book that's coming out this spring appears to be very interesting. What are some of the examples that you're going to pull from in the 2020 election cycle to make some of these biblical connotations?
Okay. The book that's coming out is actually going to come out in April. What I decided to do, Michael, was to parallel the book or to have the book come out at the time when we commemorate the first 100 days of the Biden-Harris administration. And so in chapter one, the book, I ask, why did Biden and Harris win the election? And I compare it to the story of the woman with the issue of blood who touched the hem of Jesus's garment. And he asked, who touched me? And the, and just to make in a nutshell, Biden and Harris touched the American people in a way that the challenger, Donald Trump, did not. In chapter two, I ask the question, why did Biden pick Kamala Harris? And what I reveal there, which got revealed to me, is the strong parallel between Jesus and the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well with Joe Biden and the Senate woman at the first debate. That's my parallel there. In chapter three, I talk about a person that you're going to interview soon, very soon on this podcast, Jim Clyburn, and how he compared to Naaman the leper, or really the little maid for Mrs. Naaman, really compared with Jim Clyburn, because Naaman had an incurable disease, which was leprosy. But Joe Biden also had an incurable disease, was that he was unable to win a primary election or a caucus in 32 years of running for president. And it took these two people of color, the little maid for Mrs. Naaman to deliver Naaman and Jim Clyburn to deliver Joe Biden.
And I think you also elaborated on Colin Powell's role as well. Is that true? Yes. Is that right?
Yes. When I look at the story of Naaman, and I look at Naaman, he was a man of color. He was a victorious warrior. He was one who had favor with rulers, and he was one who had an incurable disease. Colin Powell was a victorious military man with the Gulf War. He was also an advisor to five different presidents. He was also, I think I said, a man of color. And Colin Powell had an incurable disease, that of prostate cancer.
So, Mr. Olson, before I let you go, one final question. What words of encouragement, rather, can you offer to persons who are in subordinate positions who wish to move up into number one positions?
Okay. I would say to them, don't push. Time and circumstance will elevate you. And one thing that I've learned from having been in a top position, it is not as glamorous as one may think. You as a number two person really carry the organization. All one had to do, if you're a sports fan, is look at the ESPN documentary series on the Chicago Bulls last year in terms of The Last Dance. And coincidentally, episode number two was entitled Scottie Pippen. And Michael Jordan said, people can talk about me all they want, but we would not have won one, much less six championships without Scottie Pippen. There is a valuable role you play as a number two person. You are out of the spotlight. You may not get all the credit, but you will live a longer, more productive life. And you will be bilingual, and you will be very, very much wanted. And so therefore, I suggest you get a copy of my book and go to my website at timalston2ls.com and download that book. And also, if you download the book from my site, you'll also get a free copy of my other book entitled 7 Steps to Manage Ego Problems.
Mr. Tim Olson, it's been a privilege and honor. I want to go encourage my viewers and anyone who may be tuning into this later to go ahead and purchase that book. Get your hands on it now. The name of the book is The U.S. Coronavirus and the Rise of Silver Medal Leaders. This is a must read. I would encourage everyone to go ahead and take a look at it. Mr. Alston, it's been a privilege. Very interesting. Thank you so much, sir.
Michael, thank you very much and much success to you in your career.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, I'm going to have with me a very distinguished panel. And, you know, we're going to dive into what was a very eventful week right now. So much to talk about, so little time. But I'm going to go ahead and introduce the very distinguished panel. I'm going to start off with Mr. Antoine Souther. Mr. Antoine Souther is currently an associate at McGuire Woods LLP in their private equity / corporate finance practice group. Prior to that, he was an associate at Cahill, Gordon and Randell LLP in New York City. He graduated from Harvard Law School in 2017 and Oakwood University in 2014. When he's not working, Antoine likes to play video games or binge watch reality TV shows with a podcast playing in the background. I hope after this evening, it's this podcast playing in the background. Mr. Antoine, thank you so much. It's been so long since I've seen you, man.
Good to see you too. Happy to be here.
And next we have Maisha Keita, a native of Memphis, Tennessee. Maisha is an alumna of Oakwood University, where she earned a Bachelor's of Arts degree in pre-law, political science with a minor in correctional science. While at Oakwood University, she was a member of the Student Government Association, which was called the United Student Movement, and she served as the Chief Justice of the Student Supreme Court. And she was the president of the Oakwood University chapter of Phi Alpha Delta, which is a law fraternity. Upon graduating, she joined the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation as a 2019 communications intern and legislative intern to Tennessee Congressman Steve Cohen. Through these roles, she's advocated for her fellow peers, promoted voting rights and literacy, and participated in several think tank initiatives. Maisha's passion and pursuit of a law career is continuously fueled as she plans to continue her education and earn a Juris Doctorate and become an attorney. Maisha, welcome. It's such a privilege to have you. Hopefully this is not your last time. This is your first time, but I hope to have you back many times more.
Thank you, of course. Like, I'm so honored to be a part of this. I'm honored to be a part of the discussion, and I can't wait for us to, you know, dive into it.
Okay, so next we have Professor Frederick Cook, who's no guest to the political mic. He's been here a few times, and every time he adds such a wealth of knowledge. Professor Cook was born and raised in the District of Columbia. He attended the District of Columbia public school system and graduated from McKinley Technical High School in 1965. After high school, Mr. Cook enrolled at Howard University and graduated in 1969 with a degree in psychology and a commission as a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force. Mr. Cook deferred some of his U.S. Air Force service and enrolled at the Howard University School of Law, where he became a managing editor of the Howard Law Journal and chairman of the National Conference of Law Reviews for the 1971 to 1972 school year. He graduated with honors from the law school in 1972. Upon graduation, he served as the law clerk for the honorary George W. Draper II and associate judge of the Superior Court for the District of Columbia. In 1973, he was appointed a captain in the Judge Advocate General's Department of the U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, and served 4 years in that capacity. In 1977, he returned to the District of Columbia and began a law practice with a large corporate law firm specializing in telecommunications, higher education, entertainment, and corporate law. He became a partner in that law firm in 1982. In 87, he was appointed by the mayor, Marion Barry, to serve as a corporation counsel for the District of Columbia, which is now called the Attorney General for the District of Columbia, where he was the head of a law office of about 250 lawyers and an equal number of support staff. In 1990, he left that office. He left government service and returned to the private sector to practice law. In his practice, he works primarily on governmental relations, municipal finance, telecommunications, land use, public contracting, sports, advertising, litigation, intellectual property, education, and more. He has been an adjunct professor at Howard University School of Law since 1992. He is one of the founding members of the Black Entertainment and Sports Lawyers Association, a member of the Washington Bar Association Hall of Fame, and a Washingtonian Magazine Top Lawyer awardee. He also serves on several boards of not-for-profit organizations, and he's a member of the Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated. He was also my municipal law professor last semester. Professor Cook, thanks for being back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I have to apologize for that long thing he read, and I saw when you mentioned that I graduated from high school in 1965, it stunned Mr. Ford, who was like, what? How can a person who was born, who graduated from high school in 1965, still be walking the earth? What? How does that happen? That's okay, Mr. Ford. Hopefully one day you'll get there.
So next, Ariana Patton. Always a treat to have Ariana on the political mic. Ariana is a rising 2L. Oh, I'm sorry. She's a current 2L at Thurgood Marshall School of Law. She's a native of Ellenwood, Georgia. Ariana began her political journey during her senior year of high school, where she had the opportunity to intern for the late office of Congressman John Lewis. After interning for Congressman Lewis, she remained in the political field by receiving her bachelor's, her BA degree in political science from Spelman College and obtaining internships with the Georgia Legislative Black Caucus, Planned Parenthood, Public Policy Division, Coca-Cola, Toyota Government Affairs, and L'Oreal USA. Ariana currently serves as a political Instagram account, and I would encourage my viewers and followers to go follow it at the Black Girl Politico. This account educates her followers on the political process. She hopes to one day become a member of Congress. And I'm also going to add that Ariana also worked for the campaigns of Senator John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock this past December, which were very historic races. And last but not least, Mr. Jerry Ford Jr., a good friend of mine, always good to have him. Jerry is a former candidate for the Texas House of Representatives, a journalist, activist, and radio host on KJOZ 880 AM, KCOH 1230, and KTSU 90.9 FM. He's known for his involvement with the Black Lives Matter movement surrounding Sandra Bland in 2015, and has made many television appearances as a commentator on Fox 26 local news in Houston, Texas. Jerry received his Master's of Public Policy from the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston, and is currently a 3L at Howard University School of Law. Dynamic panel, accomplished panel, great resumes. Let's get into it. So I want to start off the conversation by talking about the GOP opposition to the Democrats' COVID-19 proposals. Republicans are closing ranks, it seems, against Democrats' proposed $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill, even as the White House seemed to rule out a procedural Senate power play, the reconciliation process, to protect one provision. Which this all seems to boil down to, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Despite a paper-thin congressional majority, Democratic leaders were poised to push the sweeping package through the House on Friday. They were hoping the Senate would likely serve as the place where this would take place. They were hoping that this would follow quickly enough to have legislation on President Joe Biden's desk by mid-March. The $1.9 trillion relief bill is set for a vote on the House tomorrow, but new polling shows that there's an overwhelming consensus in favor of this package. According to a Political Morning Consult poll, 76% support this bill, while 17% oppose. And when we're looking at party lines, breaking this down into along party lines, we see 60% of the GOP support it, while 30% of Republicans support it, oppose it. 89% of Democrats support, while 4% oppose, and 71% of independents support, while 22% oppose. But even with these numbers, you still have Mitch McConnell saying, "I'm sure everybody would love to get a check, but they haven't yet learned about what else is in this bill. And part of our job as a substantial minority, because remember, we're a 50-50 Senate here, is to make sure the American people fully understand what's being proposed here. Look at the size of the package, which is the size of the CARES Act that we passed in March. And we have to remember that this is not March of 2020, he says. There are hopeful signs that the economy is coming back. Vaccines are being distributed. Statistics are going in a better direction. We don't really need to resort to these measures." Lindsey Graham said this is part of a Democratic wish list. What say you, panelists? How do you characterize these criticisms with the backdrop of these polling numbers?
Yeah, Mike, I don't think there's much of an appetite for the rhetoric that we're hearing from Mitch McConnell and some of the Republicans. I think that the country sent them a very loud message, in January when the country gave the Democrats back the Senate. We elected Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I don't know what the political calculation here is to hold up a COVID relief bill when there's so many people who are hurting in this country. So hopefully, the Republican Party starts to read the tea leaves and realize that this is not just a bad policy position to take, but also it's bad politically. You know, so hopefully we can move quickly and get this passed, because I think the majority of American people are ready for some action here.
So what's your response to the criticism from Lindsey Graham that says, you know, raising the minimum wage has zero to do with COVID relief? It has everything to do with the liberal wish list. Senator Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming said, for the people who want to stay in Wyoming to work and open a small business, they want to make the wages so high, the Democrats, that the small business is going to fail before it even gets started. And then you have Joni Ernst saying, look, this is a matter of states' rights. We should push it back to the governors, and we really should allow those states to determine what is best for them, she says. What say you?
Well, I think part of the problem here is that the Republicans, the people who call themselves Republicans currently, want to be perceived as taking a policy position, but they don't have a policy position. This isn't about policy. This is not a difference of opinion about policy. The political calculus, I think, for many of these Republicans in Congress is that they want to be seen as being in opposition to a nondescript but dangerous liberal agenda. And that's really their brand. The reality of it is that this $15 an hour wage, if you go back a while, and because I'm old, I think I can do this. If you go back to the minimum wage in, pick a year, 1958, 1962, the minimum wage then, adjusted for inflation, is more than $15 an hour now. So it's not a question that the minimum wage is some inherently evil and economically destructive force in the economy. What they really want, and Lindsey Graham, you know, sort of gives away the deal when he says, well, this is all part of a Democratic, a liberal wish list, because that's really all they need to say. But they don't have a policy position. It's not as though we're arguing about, should it be $15 an hour or 18? Should it be 15 or 14? They're not making that argument. Their argument is that it's bad because liberals want it. Now, to speak to your specific question, it is part of the COVID relief bill, because what COVID has done to the economy, what COVID has exposed about the economy, are the horrible inequities that exist economically, and that people cannot take care of themselves, either for providing healthcare for themselves, housing, food for themselves. You can't stay home and help your kids with education if you don't make enough with one job, that you have to work multiple jobs. You can't be a good parent if you're doing that. So it is integral. It requires thinking in a more broad sort of way. But if these people were genuine in entering into substantive discussion, we would talk about the merits of it. But what they really want to do is say, liberals bad, conservatives good, and we don't have to have an agenda. We don't have to have policy positions. And it's unfortunate that we've devolved to this as a society.
And what's interesting about this whole, you know, scenario is that you also have Democratic senators, Kristen Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin, who have said, look, let's you know, put the brakes on this a little bit, because Joe Manchin said, look, I'm not going to go back to my constituents and say that I voted for anything over $11 an hour. So with these conservative Democrats in place, even the reconciliation process, is that a viable option in your view? Knowing that there are some Democratic senators who would have to run back to conservative constituencies and have to make the case for this, knowing that 2022 is at stake?
Probably not. I mean, I think if Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema don't support it, it has a very small chance of being successful in the Senate, because I don't think any Republicans are going to sign on for really bad reasons. I think the administration, the Biden administration, is playing a bit of a game and hoping that the parliamentarian of the Senate will bail them out so they don't have to push it and have it crash and burn. Because as all of you law students know, there is nothing in the Constitution that gives the parliamentarian of the Senate the prerogative to decide what the Senate will or will not vote for. It's just hogwash. for them to say, well, we're waiting for the parliamentarian to tell us whether we can do this or not. It has been done in the past that the parliamentarian has said this and the Senate has done the opposite. The Senate is not bound by anything the parliamentarian said because the parliamentarian is not a constitutional officer. They can't tell the Senate what to do. And that doesn't mean the parliamentarian is a bad person. It's just that if you decide you want to hide behind the parliamentarian, you can, but you don't have to. So I think part of strategically what the administration is doing is thinking, if the parliamentarian says no, then I'm off the hook. And then we have to have the fight about, are we going to get $15 an hour passed some other way? Are we going to kill the filibuster and get it approved on a straight up and down vote? But that won't happen because Sinema and Manchin are not going to vote for it no matter how you package it. So I just think, you know, it's unfortunate that Manchin and Sinema don't see the wisdom of this. But if they don't come on board, I just don't think there are two other Republican senators who are likely to replace them.
And Antoine, if you could jump in, because I'm anxious to hear your thoughts on this too. In your view, you know, is it a smart move for, you know, Democratic senators who, you know, are worrying about their election futures to, you know, pass up an opportunity to pass the minimum wage, knowing that the state of Florida passed it, and it seems to become more and more of a mainstream, you know, policy idea. It's no longer that crazy liberal idea of, you know, something that only really blue states do. You're seeing Florida, which, you know, in the past few election cycles has been a conservative state, you know, pass this $15 wage in phases. You know, what say you, sir?
Yeah, well, I think I was mentioning very, very, very succinctly that the GOP has been running against a nondescript and unknown Democrat boogeyman. Well, Democratic senators, since I can imagine, have been running to not appear as that boogeyman. And so not as to give sufficient ammo to Republicans to write in their attack ads, $15, it stands out. Right. So I think that's the first thing that is kind of like hanging over the Democrats currently. And even though it's always been, states are like the experiment stages for the nation, right? We've seen the model for the ACA is currently constructed, or is originally constructed, was done in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney, and then Barack Obama pretty much copied and pasted it and tried to apply it nationally. You've seen that states become the experimental phase for large national policy, that's, you know, large policy and reforms. However, with respect to like minimum wage, the devil's in the details with that, because many times, although the national or it's easy to market, the devil's in the details because it's going to be riddled with exceptions. We can all name positions that we know that would be exempt from that minimum wage. And however, it's just so easy to market it and brand it. It writes itself in ads. Like, all you have to do is say $15 minimum wage in South Dakota or something like that, and next thing you know, Republicans have attack ads that they can always just beat Democrats over the head with. And that's what the Democrats have really been trying to sort of step aside from and try to mitigate those attacks, as they've been able to sort of do in certain situations and sort of steer the conversation elsewhere, particularly with respect to this COVID-19 package. It's kind of interesting sort of seeing how both parties have positioned themselves, and it's almost like there's an implicit wait and see approach, as we're trying to see whether or not the economy is going to bounce back on its own, whether or not what needs help, or whether or not we do need help. Where do we need it? Is it small businesses? Oh, it's the airlines? Is it travel industry again? Would they need some more? Would it be small time? Would it be small businesses? Would it be just straight cash payments? They're trying to figure out, trying to run that balance of trying to see where, and time sort of reveals all things. So everyone is kind of implicitly waiting and seeing where is the help going to be most impactful. And the thing is, when you're negotiating with Republicans, I mean, whenever it comes to federal spending, they have this weird mantra that every dollar has to get its return on investment. It has to make sense. We saw that with Dodd-Frank, and we saw that during the bank bailout during 2007 and 2008. We saw that every dollar has to have a return value that's estimated. And unless you can conceivably and tangibly connect what you're spending on the front end to what you're going to get on the back end, it just doesn't make sense for the Republicans. So with respect to sort of waiting and allowing time to reveal a lot of things is what is sort of going on in the Republicans' mind, and Democrats are aware that these are going to create easy attack lines. And although the wide mandate that Biden, that Joseph Biden and Kamala Harris received on election, well, not necessarily election day, but a week or so after when it was actually confirmed, although it's there, it's something to where they seem to be kind of wanting to sort of play both sides a little bit and then try to see if they can get a broad consensus, as Joe Biden is an individual where we have heard many stories that he's one that always wants to try to build a consensus. And so as long as it seems that the Republicans are making some type of good faith effort or something that's going to make it easy to put in attack ads, as long as like their questions or qualms with any proposed legislation is something to where it's not going to be so easy, or something that can be easily placed into an attack ad without much help from any marketers or anything of that sort, or any PR people, it's always something where Biden and Democrats have to keep in the back of their minds, because although it's 50-50 in the Senate, I think the Dems are +3 or +5 in the House. So these are very slim margins. And so you always have to sort of keep that in the back of your mind. And I think that's where we are right now.
And it's interesting that, you know, this proposal seems to have such strong public consensus behind it, but yet it's still experiencing some opposition. And what's interesting is that we're also in a very polarized time when you can hardly get 76% of the public to agree on anything. And they agree that there's some, you know, this crisis does call for an increase in the minimum wage. And even before the crisis, there was, you know, public support gearing towards some form of an increase in the minimum wage towards $15 an hour. But does anyone want to weigh in on this before we pivot to the next? Go ahead, Aria.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say that we spent millions of dollars billing out these businesses, you know, giving small business loans to non-small businesses, you know. And I think it's important that this $15 minimum wage goes through. I mean, you have to see, like, in the time that we are in right now, $15 minimum wage is nothing, you know. Right now, well, in Georgia, I think our minimum wage is $7.75. That's not able, like, in this, especially if you have kids or, you know, family, you can't live off of that, you know. And then you think about the government assistance and, you know, what comes with minimum wage. And I think with the Republicans, their whole thing is like, oh, you know, they need to be able to, you know, quote unquote, get it on their own, or, you know, kind of work towards being able to be self-sufficient, but $7.75 is enough to be self-sufficient. So, you know, how can you at this point of time right now with everything that's going on, especially with COVID, say that, you know, $15 wouldn't be okay? I think it's a bare minimum that they need to give for COVID relief.
So yesterday, a very interesting development took place in Georgia. Georgia Republicans showed you know, their strong support for deterring voter turnout with you know, two bills that seem to have specifically legislative intents towards accomplishing that goal, for specifically SB 241 and HB 531. SB 241 would end no excuse mail voting, implement new ID requirements, and add witness requirements for male voters. And so this is, in essence, creating one of the most restrictive absentee voting laws in the entire country. And then HB 531 was also rushed out of committee yesterday in a desperate attempt for the legislation to go to the floor of the state house before crossover day. The bill would restrict drop box access, add new ID requirements for mail-in voting, and restrict weekend voting, among other provisions. I want to get your thoughts because, you know, when we saw the civil war that did take place in Georgia in December, We saw Republican infighting, and we knew at the backdrop of this was going to be, even if Ossoff and Warnock pull this off and win, their respective Senate races, we knew that there were going to be some changes, major changes towards Georgia's voting laws. From the same Republicans who are criticizing some of the conspiracies that we were seeing going on about the election being rigged and everything. In your view, how does the Democratic Party combat that? And what do you make of these new bills? Anyone can jump in. Well, don't all jump at once, but let me just also add, 2022 is around the corner. And we have seen that David Perdue has announced that he would not run for his for the Senate against Warnock. But Kelly Loeffler has expressed interest in running against Warnock. Remember, Kelly Loeffler has never won a statewide election before. So this would be a really interesting development for her to jump back into the race and run against Warnock with these new provisions in place enacted. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, to answer your previous question before I get to this is the Republicans across the country have embarked on a campaign to disenfranchise Black, brown, non-white voters, poor people, whenever and however they can. As you know, in Georgia, the voting laws that were in existence were created by Republicans because Republicans have controlled the Georgia legislature for many years in the recent past. And they thought it would work to their advantage. When it turned out that it didn't, it's a problem. Not because absentee voting is inherently bad or inherently problematic. It's problematic because we can't win doing that. And this whole discussion of changing the voter registration rules, making it more difficult to vote, is about tilting the field. Because if you can't win on substance, then they want to win on process. And that's really all the discussion for them is. So they don't have the ability because they don't have policies that resonate with the majority of people, because they don't have candidates who are particularly charismatic across the board, they have to fix the election so that they can't lose. Because if they did run on a straight up, on the merits, everybody vote however you can, they would probably lose many more times than not. They're probably right about that. So Loeffler hasn't run a statewide election. She had a lot of help in running in the Senate race, but she made the wrong bet because her political instincts are wrong. She made the wrong bet that Donald Trump would drag her across the finish line. And Donald Trump was such an albatross around her neck that she could not overcome it. And she was not politically astute enough to thread the very small eye of needle that was there to create a space for herself that didn't make her identify so closely with this incredibly unpopular human being. So, I think that what Black folk, poor people, brown people, people who give a hoot in Georgia have got to do is do just what they did in November of 2020. Is I don't care what the obstacles are, I'm going to vote. And I'm going to vote in huge numbers. And the ultimate solution is to unelect those members of the Georgia legislature who happen to be Republicans, not just a senator, not just a president, but to change the character, the composition of the Georgia legislature, House and Senate, so that you don't have to deal with this lunacy or you can undo the lunacy. But people have got to decide. And I do think that there's a lot of evidence that a good part of the Georgia electorate is ready to have that struggle and to prevail. But you can't take your foot off the gas. You can't stop organizing. You can't stop motivating people. And you got to keep people's eyes on the prize.
Yeah, Mike. I think this is Democrats have to see this coming. After the Democrats were able to take over those seats in Georgia and also win the state electoral votes, what comes to my mind is still this effect of Shelby v. Holder from a few years ago, and how that just gutted the Voters' Rights Act. So like to answer like your question that you asked earlier, like, you know, what should Democrats be looking at? I think we have to be able to draft a John Lewis new voter rights act, right? To try to, you know, make sure that our system is running smoothly and to stop some of these states like Georgia and even, you know, here in Texas, Alabama, Mississippi from, you know, passing these laws to typically prevent people of color from voting. So, you know, I really still think that the effects of Shelby v. Holder are still being felt. And it is so important right now that Democrats look at trying to put forth a new voter rights bill. And you can really honor John Lewis, you know, by doing such a thing.
And to your point, Jerry, you know, when we're talking about the Voting Rights Act, we're talking about Section 4B, which required the states to go ahead and submit changes to their voting laws with the Attorney General's office. And once that was taken out with the case you had, you know, cited, Shelby versus Holder, it's off to the races, basically, for these states to make any changes they want to without any kind of federal oversight. And so that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing that play out. And this is interesting because we do also have the Trump effect too. We're wondering what effect Trump will have. You know, that's the big question that everyone seems to have. Will Trump have a staying effect, being that he's still in a party that's so reluctant and so apprehensive to even take a vote on whether he was guilty for the incitement that took place on January the 6th? You know, being that the party seems to still be in lockstep with him because of fear for their voters, Trump's base, will that have enough staying power next year? And it seems like, you know, that fear is running up against a wall to me, at least, because look at Trump's track record. Trump came in 16, but in 18, the Republicans lost the House. And in 2020, they lost the Senate. So, you know, in your view, are those fears that, you know, the base will turn on the establishment and you know, Trump's threats of starting a third party and, you know, all of those things that are Trump related. Is that a valid concern in light of the fact that, you know, the Republican Party under Trump has not really had much of a successful track record?
Yeah, you know, I don't really think that's a valid concern. I think what we saw, you know, during the past midterms or even during the last election, and we've even seen this with the Democrats when Obama, you know, wasn't on the ticket. You know, if Trump is not on top of that ticket, then, you know, a lot of those voters are not going to come out. You know, and, you know, there were plenty of times that in this last year where Trump, I think a few times, endorsed an opposing candidate in a Republican race, and the person that he did not endorse ended up winning. So his influence is still there, but it doesn't justify the actions of a lot of these Republican legislatures right now who are looking in their political interests. Because, you know, right now, when you look at like a Liz Cheney and, you know, a lot of these Republicans who are finally standing up against them, you know, I don't think they're standing up for any moral reasons. I think they're making political calculation and they are seeing the fact that around 2022 and 2024, sticking with Trump is not going to be good for their political career. So I think more and more Republicans are starting to see and understand that fact. And I think when that actually hit the majority of the Republican Party, we're going to start seeing more and more people pull away from the former president.
So a lot of people have been saying, look, you know, what motivated a lot of folks to vote Democrat was their hatred of Trump or their strong opposition to him being in that office. There was such an atmosphere of anxiety on election day that I remember. It felt like you can cut the anxiety with a knife. It was just very intense. Will that same energy be sustained next year? You know, Maisha, in your view, you know, do you think that what Biden has done in terms of his policies, and, you know, we're not even at the 100-day mark yet, but so far, do you feel as if, you know, if he continues on this trend, there'll be enough people on the left or in the independent column who are leaning left to have a repeat of, you know, a Georgia 2020?
I would say yes. I was previously a poll worker for this past election, so I was able to see firsthand, you know, the massive drive of people coming in to vote, you know, to vote against Trump. And so it's all about momentum, keeping that momentum and remembering, you know, the purpose of voting. And it's not just, you know, to remove one specific person, but it's to continuously exercise your right. So I do think it's possible that Biden will continue to encourage, you know, people to exercise their voting rights and encourage political efficacy at all times, even within his 100 days. As long as he's promoting and showing, you know, his progress and the policies that he's putting forth, will bring forth a satisfaction, relief that he's doing, you know, the policies that that he's promoted on his platform. And the reason that these people gave him their vote.
So does anyone else want to weigh in? Because I do want to talk about the Texas crisis, because President Joe Biden approved a major disaster declaration for Texas recently, as the state remained in a lockdown state. And so, you know, there was a long period where there seems to be no coordination in terms of the leadership in the state level. Biden approved the disaster declaration for Texas this past Friday. And after he spoke with Governor Greg Abbott about the situation in the state. And this was according to a White House statement. So Governor Abbott, though, said in a release statement later that Saturday that Biden only partially approved Texas's call for the declaration of a 254 counties for both individual and public assistance. Biden approved the public assistance for every county, but only assistance for individuals affected in 77 counties. Jerry, you're down there on the ground. You know, in your view, has the federal response been adequate? And you know, how do you compare the federal response to the state response? Yeah.
You know, I think this federal government, you know, could do a little bit more. But I think, you know, Houston's the energy capital of the world, and you know, Texans love to brag about this. And you know, so the irony of the energy crisis and like the rolling blackouts, you know, really isn't lost, you know, on me. But you know, when you really look at the situation, because people are kind of, you know, confused about like what is happening here, you have these interconnected regional grids that serve most of the rest of the country. So you have the eastern grid and you have the western grid. But Texas, ERCOT grid, which, you know, if you spend, you know, a lot of time in East Texas, you'll be reminded that it was the former Republic of Texas, and that independent mindset is really still ingrained, not just in like the residents, but also in the policymakers. But you have this Texas grid that is essentially like standing on its own. And, you know, this limits really the power of the imports and exports during like extreme conditions. So like you have a state like Minnesota or California, when they have these extreme winter conditions, they can draw upon, you know, their interstate power connection and, you know, and use that grid to really power, you know, their state. You know, the fact that the Texas grid is so isolated from, you know, the eastern and the western parts of the country, it really put forth an issue that we saw take place this last week. And like, you know, you have these massive natural gas and like wind generation infrastructure here in Texas that, you know, is not ready for a winter storm, right? There needs to be deeper investments from state officials when you're looking at our infrastructure and our ability to deal with, you know, these type of winter storms. You had some turbines that were down due to freezing weather, which makes absolutely no sense that we don't have the anti-freezing technologies here. That, you know, would, you know, require additional investments. But, you know, most other, you know, countries and areas of our country has been able to make those type of investments to prevent this from happening. But, you know, I think the state officials here have to make some really different decisions when it's coming to this discussion about like our energy grid. There has to be some investments for our infrastructure because this was completely unacceptable. It led to so many, you know, some lives being changed, but some lives being lost. So, you know, I think that when you look at the state of Texas, you know, they have spent a lot of time developing, you know, strategic oil reserves. I think it's time to start thinking about like strategic energy reserves here if we're going to remain independent and isolate ourselves from the rest of the country. And, you know, I think, you know, hopefully the Biden administration has stepped in. I think that, you know, Texas it probably is in need of, you know, a little more additional help just because of the incompetence of our governor, Greg Abbott, and the Republican Party here, who, you know, has been remaining in control for so many years. But I do think that, you know, hopefully the Biden administration comes in with some more funding and some more help. And the Texas officials really need to have a deep discussion about the way we move forward to prevent this from happening again.
And you know, I heard a lot of young people, particularly on the left side, saying, look, the Democratic Party takes advantage of us. They are expecting our vote. They're expecting us to come out in droves without having to work much for it. You know, I heard a lot of that last year, especially when Bernie Sanders lost the primary. But, you know, in looking at what Democrats have done for the state of Texas, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez raising over $5 billion, Beto O'Rourke, you know, hitting the ground, using his social media platform to keep people updated as to how much water has been donated, how much funds have been donated through his organization Powered by People. You know, how do you, you know, get the message across that, look, you have a party that's clearly doing better than the other? You know, that's just looking at it objectively. You know, how do you get that across to people who are just looking at the noise and just looking at, you know, this in juxtaposition with all kinds of different crises in the country that are happening right now?
Yeah, I think you have to have someone who understands, you know, the landscape in Texas, the political landscape, which is, I think, is so uniquely different than around the country. You know, like this last election, there was a lot of this discussion about, because there's a change in demographic and you had these big metro areas in Houston, Dallas, and Austin, San Antonio, with these, you know, large liberal voters coming out and voting in high numbers, that it looks like that, you know, Joe Biden had a chance to, you know, possibly win the state. But then you look down towards the border and you had these very, you know, large Hispanic counties that went and voted for Donald Trump. And you know, and they, it's a reason for that, right? And I think a lot of Democrats kind of overlook that fact. They, you know, a lot of, I think a lot of the Democratic leaders have kind of taken some communities for granted here in Texas. You know, I think the Democratic Party for a long time has taken the Black community for granted in some situations, but they, you know, I think the politicians here have spoken to a lot of our concerns. But I think you just got to look at having a leadership here in the state that can talk to, you know, everybody around the state and understand that you have to talk to, I think, Texas Democrats a little different than you would talk to Democrats like around the country. I think Beto O'Rourke right now is thinking about, you know, running for governor. And, you know, I was a big supporter of his in 2018, but I can already see one of the commercials that the Republicans going to run when he was at Texas Southern and at the debate. And he said that he's going to take everybody guns away. Look, I'm for that, like personally, like I'm for that message. But I just know, you know, it's not going to resonate with some populations here in the state. So I think Democrats have a big uphill battle. But, you know, you look again, like this is a large state. This is such a large state and large area that you have to really cover.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think Texas is kind of microcosmically like much of the South or the United States. I think that historically, so-called Democrat politicians have taken for granted Black and brown votes and poor people's votes and so-called progressive folks' votes. I think one of the failings of the current, well, the more senior crop of Democrat Party leaders is that they really have not been connected to their constituencies in a meaningful way, except on election day. And I think Ocasio-Cortez going to Texas and showing that there's a different mindset is important. But I think that has to happen in Georgia and in Mississippi and in New York State and in Illinois and across the country, because Democrats have been their own worst enemy in a lot of ways. They have given the Republicans easy arguments to make about them not being serious in caring about you. When Democrats control the House and the Senate or the presidency at any point in time, it was difficult to convince people that they cared about them. I believe that the environment is a very serious problem. I believe that there are industries in this country that pollute the environment and make our lives less good. But you can't tell a coal miner in West Virginia that you're going to close the coal plant and not give them another way to put food on their table. You can't do that. And Democrats too long have done that. They have talked about the very high sounding, moralistic, ethical way of approaching government, but not really relating that to the man and woman who it directly affects. When you say you want to change the automobile industry because they're polluting the environment, I applaud that. But when you unemploy people, you got to give them some job training. You got to give them another way to make a living, because otherwise what they say is, then you really care about me. And then some Republican jackass comes along and says, I'm going to bring the coal business back. I'm going to bring the steel people back. Those people are so desperate to have food on their table to take care of their kids. They know you, Mr. Democrat or Ms. Democrat, you've abandoned them. They don't know whether this other guy's lying or not, but that's a better bet than betting on the guy who shafted me, okay? And that's where Democrats, I think, have been their own worst enemy. And they've got to be serious about connecting with people, about not just talking about, well, we want to talk about kitchen table issues. Well, don't just talk about it, as we like to say in the 60s, be about it. Do something for those people. Help them take care of themselves. And I think that Texas, much like Georgia, has made the same sort of mistake, if you will. That is to say, when you invite industry to your state, when you just try to create economic growth, you bring in different people. You bring in different thoughts. You bring in a different way of approaching the world. And Georgia found out, the Georgia Republicans found out the hard way, that the whole lot of people that come to Georgia who weren't those good old boys anymore, and you couldn't count on the good old boy vote to get you over. And I don't think Texas is as close to turning blue as Georgia was this last time around. But I think in two or three cycles, Texas is going to be, much like Georgia was recently, that they're going to have enough people who are energized and motivated against the lunacy of the Republicans, who say things as crazy as the government doesn't owe you anything, your job is to take care of yourself. That's going to push them out of the way. And so it's going to take a while, but I think people like Mr. Ford and others in Texas are going to keep agitating, keep pushing, keep moving, and Texas is going to move. But you got to connect with people on a human level. You can't just be this kind of distant intellectual political person to say, well, I know what's best for you, but I don't have to talk to you about it. That just doesn't going to work.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that one thing that the Republicans do is, like, they have a better way of getting out the message. They, you know, they take what Democrats say and they're like, well, here's why this is wrong, you know, rather than, and Democrats, they kind of go in a way of, you know, I know what's best for you. And so this is, you know, these are the policies that we should talk about. This is what we should do for this particular state, instead of going in and asking, hey, you know, what exactly do you need? And I think that's a major problem that the Democrats have, and they need to move towards asking rather than telling, because you do have those citizens, you know, that they speak, a lot of Democrats, they speak high level politics instead of kind of going down and, like, you know, basic level, saying, you know, hey, this is what's going to happen. This is how it affects your community. You know, what do you think about it? If we bring this major organization in, or we bring this major corporation in, how would that affect you specifically? You know, what do you, you know, what do you want to see within your communities? And I think that that's something that they really do need to look at doing when, you know, bringing these people in.
So, recently, a New York prosecutor, Cyrus Vance, has obtained copies of Donald Trump's tax returns. This has been a long time coming. You know, after the Supreme Court this week rejected the former president's last-ditch effort to prevent them from being handed over, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office enforced a subpoena on President Trump's accounting firm within hours of the Supreme Court's ruling on this past Monday. And this now has the documents in hand. And a spokesperson for the office, Danny Frost, said this past, today, that the district attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., had been fighting for a year and a half to access these tax returns for a criminal grand jury investigation into his business dealings. These documents are protected by grand jury secrecy rules and are not expected to be made public to the you know, public to us. But, you know, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about Mitch McConnell's speech on the Senate floor, where he said, look, I'm voting to acquit the president, but that doesn't mean he's not open to criminal liability. I'm thinking about all the times in which the Senate has had the opportunity, not just in this past impeachment, but the first impeachment, where he was calling a foreign official and saying, look, I would like to do us a favor if you give me some dirt on my potential opponent, Joe Biden. You know, they've had opportunities to try to set the moral standard and to let their party be a party of, OK, we have a baseline. We have a moral base right here. And this is not this is the line and we're not going to cross it. But, you know, at this point, you know, being that Trump, if he is going to be convicted for this criminal charge, this will affect whether or not he can run again. You know, it seems as if the Republicans have held his hand this long and they're not letting him go. So if anything does happen, the Republicans would still face the backlash, I guess, of the same majority of folks who came out in droves in November. What say you?
Yeah, I think this is very interesting because I think the past couple years or so has become apparently clear that federally, Trump is pretty much immune from federal prosecution. The Senate has acquitted him twice now. He's been impeached, but both times he was acquitted. However, there's one thing that he like probably hasn't counted on is that, you know, we have a system of federalism here to where the states themselves can come after him. And one of my favorite lawyers in ever is New York Attorney General Letitia James, and she's coming after him quickly now. She got access to his tax records and I'm excited or anticipate federal or state charges regarding some of the schemes that he uses and business practices that he used, which will ultimately hurt him. And that's a question of at this point in time, like how will it be phrased and how would it be and how will it impact his base? Because one thing that I think a lot of Democrats and Republicans as well, thinking of the Lincoln Project and various other Republican groups, they underestimated that Trump, ever since he came down the elevator, he was always the favorite. Say what you will about polling and how accurate it is, but he was always the favorite. He was always leading in the polls. He always had the plurality. And then once the field shrunk a little bit, he was the majority, of course. So his voters, his base is it was around long before we thought anyone thought that he had a long shot in winning at all. So he commands like these groups of people. Like everyone says, the 35% baseline that he comes from. I think it's maybe a little higher than that, but you know, whatever. It's math, stats. but I mean, I think it's what federally he's been sort of shooting, and even when they did indict him, it was a rallying point for some of his voters and some of his constituents, which is amazing to me. Like the world of politics just doesn't compute around him somewhat. He operates a little bit, like his voters operate a little bit differently because we're so polarized, as you mentioned earlier, and how the echo chambers can sort of get together and sort of frame that, oh, he's innocent, he got acquitted. You know, Pelosi couldn't stop him, ha ha ha, you know, we own the libs. As like, you know, Fox News always says. But I mean, I think that once the charges are brought and you can sort of pierce that persona a little bit, because so much of it is just him just like sort of escaping, right? And sort of seeing that, okay, I'm invaluable, right? Like, oh, he's filed bankruptcy, what, 4 or 5 times? Oh, you know, it makes me smart, I got away. But like, you can't really escape those prosecution charges when they come for you. You have to own up to them. You have to, all right, so I was committing fraud or something to that effect, right? Like, and I'm not exactly sure about what exactly the laws would be and what, if any, prison time would that bring or jail time would that bring. But I mean, you want to sort of pierce that, you sort of want to pierce that veil and sort of get in a little bit and sort of eradicate that mystique a little bit that he sort of holds over his voters and the 35% or 40% of the country. That's, I don't know what, 40-45% of the Republican base at the very minimum. So you kind of want to, I think that's one way, it's a way you can sort of do it. And I think that's what the New York Attorney General is I don't know if she's trying to do it, but I mean, it's clear that his business practices were not up to par. And it, I think just sort of getting to that and sort of piercing that persona, that Trump persona, the Trump mist, will probably be key to sort of ushering him out the window. I mean, out the door a little bit, sort of how Mitt Romney sort of discussed a little bit, how that if he ran today, he'd win in a landslide in 2024. I mean, that's kind of terrifying considering that over the last 4 years that we've seen. I don't really want to see that again. But
it is interesting, because what I was thinking about, what some conservative friends of mine said about the incitement charges in the Senate trial, they were saying, look, it wasn't clear that Trump was actually guilty of incitement. And I was like, that just seemed like a textbook answer. Like anyone who's read Brandenburg versus Ohio knows, words that are likely to cause imminent lawless harm and actually do cause imminent lawless harm are considered incitement. And that's exactly what happened. He said words that were likely to cause the reaction that it did, and they stormed the Capitol and it happened. And yet he was let off the hook. And, of course, they're going to argue, it was because of the standing. It was because of the fact that, he was no longer in office. And, they'll avoid that. But in this case, now you have a prosecution. And people are wondering, well, what specifically is the prosecution looking for? Well, look, they're examining whether Trump and his business lied about the value of assets to gain favorable loan terms and tax benefits. The district attorney is also scrutinizing hush money payments paid to women, on Trump's behalf. So yes, we do have a clear violation of tax law. And I think about, the fact that, when you go back to the 1920s with Al Capone was committing all kinds of atrocities. They didn't get him on any of those crimes he committed. They got him on tax evasion. That's what they got him on. Any other thoughts?
Yeah. I think
you're right. I mean, look, The DA in New York is looking to see if he's been if he's committed bank fraud under the New York state law, whether he's committed tax fraud or tax evasion under the New York tax law, whether he has been involved in racketeering under the New York state law. So he's got a problem potentially with all those crimes, which carry significant jail sentences. Now, because he didn't get a pardon for any of these offenses under the presidential pardon power, the district attorney in Manhattan can make a referral to the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, can get a sharing agreement, which is what we called it when I was a prosecutor, and share the grand jury information of the New York grand jury with a federal grand jury. So he has the potential for jeopardy. Now, whether all is going to happen, I clearly don't know, because I don't know enough about the facts. But there's the potential for exposure that, were I advising him as his attorney, this would be very worrisome because there's a lot of bad stuff that could happen here.
I think someone else is going to weigh in real quick.
I was just going to say that I think it shows a divide between federal government and state government, especially the court system, now that Trump is no longer president. Though he was given immunity and giving a special treatment while in the federal government, being acquitted and evading two impeachment trials, now he's subjected to, state courts, state judges who are now investigating potential and confirmed crimes that he's committed. And so with this divide, it shows that, he might have had that immunity at one point, but showing that state governments see that he might have been president, it no longer shows that he is untouchable. So I think now is an opportunity to keep him from running next year, or just showing that no one can evade the criminal court system.
That's a good point. And I just want to go ahead and thank each of you, Ariana Patton, Jerry Ford Jr., Antoine Southern, Maisha Keith, and Professor Fred Cook, for what you brought tonight on the Political Mic. This was a really insightful discussion. I really enjoyed it. And I want to thank the viewers for hanging tight with me for two segments. This is the first time I did two segments, one-on-one interview with author Tim Alston. And you, amazing panelists. So thank you so much. I want to go ahead and encourage those who tune in regularly to tune in again next week. I'll be joined with House Majority Whip and South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn. We're going to be having a really insightful discussion. I hope you all will tune in for that. With that being said, I want to thank you guys again for being a part of this panel. You brought so much to the table. And I want to go ahead and end episode 32 of the Political Mike podcast. Thank you.